colleagues, let me welcome you to this meeting of the Academic Board. I'm Craig Calhoun. In the process of welcoming you, I'm welcoming myself to my first Academic Board meeting. It's a pleasure to be at the LSE. It's a pleasure to be with you. Unfortunately, our first bit of business is sadly to recognize the loss of a colleague due to death. And I would like to ask you all to stand for a minute's silence in tribute to Professor Sudipto Bhattacharya, who died unexpectedly during the summer vacation. As most of you will know, Sudipto had been a professor of finance at the LSE since 1995 and played an instrumental role in transforming the school's finance group from a handful of academics into a large and vibrant modern finance department with a faculty of over 30. May we share a moment of silence. Thank you very much. It's in the nature of any group of colleagues that there will be the sadness of loss, the pleasure of gain as we welcome new colleagues and simply have the chance to see each other again at the beginning of the new year. This is, of course, a heightened experience for me since this is the beginning of a new period of my life, joining you at the LSE. I want today just to speak very briefly and then to invite questions and comments. Let me say first, I'm thrilled to be here. The LSE is an extraordinary institution. It took me less than 30 seconds to make up my mind to accept the offer when it was suggested that I become head. I should say when it was first suggested by the headhunter hired by the search committee, it took me less than 30 seconds to say, yeah, well, sure, it'll never happen. It did happen, a bit to my surprise. I'm delighted it happened. I've been working 12 hours a day for my first 7 weeks, and I'm still delighted that it happened, though I'm hoping that that workload will be reduced slightly in the months and years to come. I intend to remain one of you, that is, a member of the teaching faculty, a member of the research committed teaching faculty of the LSE. I hope still to write. I have been in the classroom already teaching offering two lectures in LSE 100, joining my colleague Danny Kwa in debate, in which it was conclusively established that the LSE will retain both economics and sociology among its departments. When I say it is my intention, I actually have to admit that so far my reality merely allows for this possibility as a future option. That is, I haven't had time to do research or write, and my teaching has been the result of having made commitments many months ago that I wouldn't have made if they had come up last week. That said, it really is an intention. It is my sense of myself in the university to be very much a part of the faculty. I'm conscious that I have somewhat different job definition and responsibilities from others in the faculty, and I'm conscious that that will require us sometimes to engage in vigorous debate as well as cooperative activity. But my understanding is that that's what you do anyway. That the LSE is an institution devoted to vigorous debate, to improving knowledge by the kind of questioning that comes when colleagues ask about the evidentiary basis of decisions or arguments, when colleagues ask about the theories or analyses on which these are based. I hope that we will proceed in that vein. That is, I hope that we will proceed as social scientists to consider the affairs of this university, after all, a social science university. And that will mean looking at the evidence, looking at the arguments, and on that basis, trying to reach decisions. But decisions about what? I come to an institution that is not broken, and I therefore don't intend to fix it. But I come to an institution that has a variety of issues and concerns. The LSE operates in an extraordinarily turbulent environment. And turbulent is a sort of nice way for saying that the environment is becoming more and more problematic for us. It isn't one which is simply getting a bit choppy and the waves are rocking the boat. It's one in which there are real dangers, if not of sinking. I really don't think there's much chance of disappearing as an institution, but dangers of losing our focus as an institution, not being what we want to be as an institution. I think that the environmental issues are many. They range from the changes in funding carried out by the British government, and not just the current government, but governments over a period of years, to the extent to which the world in which we work has become intensely competitive, and parts of that in which we once were the unquestioned and clear leaders, parts of the global master's degree environment, are now mature. They have lots of players. There's an intense competition for leaders. We have to ask about how we fit into that. The founders of the LSE offer a narrative that I think gets repeated over and over, and everyone who narrates that has their own particular spin that they want to put on the story of the founders. But I want to put one bit of spin on that and claim the story by saying that part of why the LSE was created back in 1895 was a conviction that in a new era, new knowledge was created. New knowledge was needed. Right? The LSE should be pioneering. The LSE should be innovative. The LSE should be bringing knowledge in subjects that were not being taught at Oxford and Cambridge. The LSE should be bringing that to students who are chosen in a different way, much more open without regards to class privilege. The LSE should be located in the city and of the city in various ways, not in isolation or retreat from the city. It should be of the highest possible intellectual standard, precisely because the best way to improve the world was to bring the highest possible intellectual standards to the making of government policy, to projects of social reform, including when carried out by non-government organizations or advocated by social movements. So I think we could say we share still lots of that mission. But we can't really say that honestly unless we're also prepared to say this too is a new era that can require new kinds of knowledge, that just reproducing the structures that we have inherited from our immediate past and all the way back to the founders isn't going to be adequate to the new era any more than it was adequate for Oxford University to decide that that newfangled subject of economics just was never really going to take root and didn't deserve to have a proper professorship. Okay? If we are serious about the LSE, need to ask, I think, what is the distinctive value added of the LSE? What is the distinctive character of the LSE that makes it stand out so that people should be sad if the LSE isn't here, if the LSE isn't performing this role? That character is not being the second or third or fourth rated university in Britain. We care about being highly ranked, but that's not our goal. Right? We believe we contribute something distinctive and something special in each department, in each research institute, in the university as a whole. I think that our commitments are to do work that really matters in various ways, not just more work. Okay? Now, in that, we hope that this will be reflected by high rankings. We hope that it will be reflected by high ratios of applicants to available places for our programs. We hope that it will be reflected by eagerness of colleagues to take positions we offer. But we're clear, or at least I want to imagine that we all want to be clear, about a sense of purpose. And I wonder whether we are fully clear about it at various levels. And with that, I wonder whether, to whatever extent we're clear about it, are we well focused on trying to pursue that mission, to achieve the purpose that we set ourselves. So what I want to ask for this year is a discussion, an inquiry. I'm going to call it a strategic review, but strategy starts from being clear what you're trying to achieve, and then asking about the means to achieve it, the ways in which the environment creates both opportunities and challenges, how to build on the already established strengths we have, and what it is that we need to add to that. So I want to call for the strategic review, not just because that's the kind of thing that new directors do when they show up on the job, but because I'm genuinely concerned. As I've studied up on the LSE over the last several months, and I've visited for about a week a month all year, I've read what I could read, not just of books about the history of the LSE, but of works by many of you, statements of the department, what's on our website. I've met with a number of colleagues. I'm concerned that we're doing a terrific job of dealing with problems as they come our way, but a less terrific job of clarifying our purposes and pursuing them strategically, thinking about where we want to be 5 years out and into the future beyond that. And I hope that we will be able to have a discussion that is helpful to us in this way. And I'm going to, in the 5 minutes or so that I keep talking before opening this to questions, just give some idea of why I think that's important, why I think that's not just a sort of routine to go through. I think that there's a big difference between solving problems reactively and having a sense of where you're trying to go. And I think that this pertains to a whole variety of things, including just having a new director. You presumably have ideas about where I ought to go and the school ought to go while I'm here. And for those ideas to matter, they need to be part of a collective discussion, for them to be influential, for them to shape the direction. But it's not just a new director comes. For a number of years, I believe there's been the declaration that we are going to rebuild the center buildings. I would like to say firmly, we are going to rebuild the center buildings. But rebuilding the center buildings is an occasion for thinking strategically. Right? What goes into the center buildings? Not just what is there now. Right? What kind of buildings do we want? Just functional cubes of a certain number of square feet, buildings that are designed in a way that brings some specific aesthetic virtues into the campus, buildings that link some of our new structures up towards Lincoln's Inn Field to the rest of the campus. How do we think about what these buildings are going to bring? How will they enhance the student experience at different levels? How will they make the LSE a better place to work for its faculty? Okay. Strategic considerations. There are more. How will we pay for the center buildings? Okay? And this goes not just for the center buildings, of course, but for other possible expansions, right? Other possible new space, other possible remodeling of existing space. Right? And it's not just space. I think that we need to think about the way in which we are funded, the purposes we spend that money on in the short run, and the long-term goals that that's intended to achieve. And I have some other ideas about this, well, about details, but about the big picture question. So we've just seen a transformation in the funding of British students for higher education. I don't have any terrific insight into British policy on this, but I think there's no particular reason to believe it's going to be reversed soon. All right? It is true that some have called for the Labour Party to impose a cap on student fees at £6,000 instead of £9,000. This may or may not ever become policy even for the Labour Party, let alone for a government in office. Right? But it still leaves open questions. What would happen to us if there were a £6,000 cap? Right? Would that be good? Well, it wouldn't obviously be good or an answerable question unless we knew where the other money was going to come from. If a £6,000 cap were imposed and the government decided to allocate huge amounts of new money to finance universities, that might be something that we would embrace and feel good about. Of course, we, the LSE, might worry if in doing this, making this allocation, the government said, as the current government has generally said, when we say we want to advance knowledge, we mean science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We don't mean social science. Right? And it's entirely possible that a return to reliance on government grant structures combined with a student cap, a cap on student fees at something like £6,000 would be coupled with a skewed funding regime that would be very problematic for an institution like the LSE. Right? So whatever decisions the government makes, it seems to me we are now in a world where we cannot take for granted any sort of old status quo ante of government funding. Okay? There are only a limited number of places that money can come from. Right? If it doesn't come in some form of government grants, block grants, whether labeled as teaching, research, whatever, right? There are really about three main places it can come from. It can come from research contracts of various kinds and other contracts to deliver services. These enable faculty members to do research. They have an important role, but they mostly pay for extras, right? Not for the core operations of the institution. They may bring overheads that help pay for space or something, but fundamentally, they pay for extra activity. They do not pay the costs of having an LSE in the first place. Okay? There are big grants that we get. And I might say that the size of the grant is not strongly correlated with the extent to which it brings extra revenues to the LSE. Quite the opposite. Okay? But in any case, pursuing those extras, which is a good thing that enables work that you want to do, doesn't fund the institution, and it is a relatively small percentage of our overall budget. Okay? We have a variety of ancillary activities that are somewhat like research activities. We raise money by charging for residence halls, but it just goes to pay for the residence halls. We have a whole number of these operations. Some of them, like LSE Enterprise, are profit-making and essentially contribute money to the institution. Okay? But for the most part, this is relatively small. Right? What we really do rely on for the additional funds is student fees. Right? Not just in making up government costs, but in paying for our costs overall. The LSE has operated for a long time on a business model that depends on fee income from students. If we sort of face this seriously, we have international students, we have postgraduate students, we have some courses that are more expensive than other courses. We have a whole complex set of operations based on student fees. Your salaries and the salaries of new colleagues who are hired are based very largely on student fees. Now, this is perfectly reasonable. A lot of universities around the world do this. But I would suggest that we don't want to assume that all of the costs of being a wonderful, excellent, world-class university with cutting-edge research programs and dealing with basic issues in our time, climate change, urban studies, development, should be borne by student fees. I assume that this body is not committed to the cause of raising student fees, or it would have raised student fees to £9,000 a year last year. I assume that there is some ambivalence about relying heavily on student fees, whatever the right answer should have been about the fee setting last year, 8 or 8.5 or 9, right? And that we recognize that this imposes a hardship on some students. So we would also like to offer offsetting bursaries, scholarships, financial aid. Right? But this takes away, then, from the contribution of student fees to the overall cost of running the school. Where else does money come from? It comes from private philanthropy. Not very much at the LSE, but a little bit, right? To defray some costs. I think that we are underserved by this sort of funding. We do not have anywhere near the number of endowed chairs that our peer universities have, for example. We are hampered in our recruitment by lack of resources. We are hampered in retention when people get offers from outside. I would put it to you that you are underpaid. If any disagree, just hold it down, right? I am not putting it to you that we have the money to pay you lots more. I am suggesting that we have an interest in getting the money to pay you more, and to be as effective as possible in competing for excellence where we need to compete for excellence. We don't want to try to achieve excellence by a regime of punishments. We want to try to achieve it by rewards, by effective support, by creating the context in which people can do the best possible work. And that requires resources. So, I would like to call for us to join in hoping that the government will carry more of that burden. but not taking it for granted that we will achieve that. I would like us to help to make clear that students get good value when they pay for an outstanding LSE education and a degree from such an extraordinary world-recognized institution, and translate that into a commitment to better teaching and strengthening the student experience. Right? I would like us to continue to get research grants, but recognize that as important as they are for fulfilling our vital research mission, they don't pay for the rest of our costs. And I would like to explore the possibility that with our committed alumni and a range of other friends around the world, we have the potential to benefit more from private philanthropy. So in the strategic review, I want to start by talking about what we're trying to achieve. I think one of the big problems with saying that we want to raise more money from any source, including private philanthropy, is imagining that the end or goal is raising more money. We don't want more money for more money's sake, right? It's not our goal to just go out and raise money. It is our goal to do good things in the world. We need to be clear what these are. They include offering the best possible education at different levels. They include doing cutting-edge research that expands the knowledge base. They include a program of public engagement that is possibly unparalleled among the world's universities. Right? How do we pay for these? We need resources, but we need them only to pay for these things that we hold to be really good and really important. Okay? So we have to start with purpose. We then have to ask questions about how we get to that purpose, which are intimately related to this. I've talked about these in the Council Away Day, the LSE Council, under a small number of major headings. And the headings are a bit arbitrary, as you'll see, but the points are serious. One of them is something that came to be known in discussions as size and shape. How big should the LSE be, and how should the students in it be distributed? Let me just give small examples, because all of this will come out in the future. But what about the proportion undergraduate and postgraduate? We're close to half and half, about 48-52 right now. So very close to evenly divided. That's the result of a variety of decisions, I think, made mostly sensibly over a long period of time in different operating conditions than those we're in now. What do we think is right now? Some departments already are exploring shifting the balance of their teaching towards a bigger percentage undergraduate. Some departments want to remain postgraduate only. There's no necessary reason this has to be a one-size-fits-all model. Departments should be discussing what they want to do. Do they want to offer more third-year options to our extraordinary undergraduates? I think that would make sense because we do have wonderful undergraduates and we don't give them the chance to specialize and get close to the focus of research that we give to our master's students. But a lot of those undergraduates are exceptionally good and able to do that. So we should look at that. Right? We should look at it aware that there is this shifting field of competition for master's degrees, and asking whether we have the students we want, whether we have the degree offer we want, the master's programs we want. And that can be not just open it or close it, but should it be expanded to 2 years? Should it be reorganized in the curriculum? Should it have be a more general degree with various tracks, or should there be separate degrees? I don't know the answer to all those questions, and I think for the most part, they are better answered by people close to the programs than by anyone in a central role. We should look at the offer. We should look at the proportion of students who are home in EU, the proportion of students who are international more broadly. Is it the right proportion? I suspect we would all agree that we're proud and happy that the LSE is extraordinarily global. We might or might not think we have the right proportion of British students in the LSE. We might want to inquire into that and look at this in the context where the funding has changed. It's not reached parity, but now with the new fee regime, it is no longer a big cost to the LSE in the way that it used to be to have a higher proportion of home and EU students. The cost is smaller. So we can look at this. Right? There are a whole series of issues about what we offer, to whom we offer it, at what level we offer it. Should we have more executive programs, right? Should we? How do we invest in PhDs and raise money for them? We now have, I think, the WISE program of trying to focus the PhD program on people we are funding who can give their full-time effort to it, right? But we would like to be able to support more PhD students and have the resources to do it, okay? All these questions about size and shape are on the table. There are questions about how we work internationally. The LSE has, and indeed, how we work in Britain in various ways. Let me sort of note close comparisons first. UCL, growing from somewhat similar size in the past to a dramatically different scale, absorbing other institutions on the way, most recently the Institute of Education, starting a secondary school, building a new campus out at Stratford. King's College, which is essentially a merger and acquisition project, which has brought together four different institutions, and which is now building its own new campus in Rotherhithe. Right? Our competitive environment is shaped by these institutions. They are models we can look at. It's not at all obvious to me that we want to be that big or that we want to work on multiple sites in Britain. But we should ask ourselves what we want, be clear about it. For my own personal taste, the decision to stay right here where we are was a good decision when it was made 10 or 15 years ago. Okay? But it imposes burdens on us. Any space for expansion is much more expensive. Right? It's a challenge for faculty at various levels, especially for young faculty as they start families or try to expand housing, to be able to afford to live in close proximity to the LSE. And we lose people sometimes because of that. So we need to look at what we're doing there internationally. I come from a university that began to open international campuses in Abu Dhabi and Shanghai. Right? That strategy has been directly advocated to me by David Willits here. Glad to see that you came from NYU. We see universities as an export industry. How many campuses do you think the LSE could support internationally? First meeting. Okay? Now, this is environmental pressure, and this is an opportunity. I have no doubt that our reputation would enable us to open a number of campuses internationally to applause from some in those local areas. I have no doubt that would be controversial. What we want to do internationally is part of what we should ask ourselves. What are we trying to accomplish? Do we want to build on the partnerships that we have and have partnerships with comparably strong institutions in different countries, with Beijing University in China, with leading universities, Cape Town, South Africa, Columbia, New York, right? How do we want to work internationally? I think we're pretty committed to being international. I think we believe that means more than simply opening our doors to international students coming here and then, for my personal taste, fighting with the British government and the police about how to treat them once they get here. I think it also means asking what we do overseas. Do we conduct executive programs? Summer schools. We have a thriving summer school in Beijing, right? Really outstanding, doing great work. Some of you have taught in it. Right? What do we want to expand, if anything, and how? And what will the effects be here if we expand? What does it do to our offerings here in our core and home departments if people are doing more of these other things? So we have an issue about multiple campuses, off-site, how we work internationally. Right? And in this issue, I've told you my own bias, which is my intention throughout this discussion. I'm not going to try to hide my opinions, but I'm not going to try to impose my opinions. I want to have a discussion. Right? So I'm going to bet that there's good reason to be cautious about overseas campuses, but I'm going to listen if somebody makes an argument in favor of overseas campuses. Okay? And for every other point, too. There are other discussion points. What about expanding the estate? How much would we value additional real estate? Right? Does it come with additional students? Well, if we were to have 1,000 more students, we would need more faculty. We'd have to have more offices for the faculty, and so forth. Okay? So we have these strategic issues to consider, all of them based on a sense of purpose. Now, in order to carry out this discussion, what I invite is discussions in departments, in research centers, everywhere, about clarifying their sense of purpose, and I hope to organize these to feed into a common discussion. This discussion will take place partly in task forces and special meetings called for this purpose, some of them just with members of the teaching staff, some of them bringing together other constituencies, members of the court and counsel, or students, or alumni. All right. These will talk about the various issues that we're facing. They will feed back into task forces, and these will feed into the regular standing academic committees and back to the academic board. I hope this process can be as transparent as possible, that we can have just be an open discussion, recognizing that putting something on the table doesn't mean that we've decided to do it. It means we've decided to talk about it, and we will figure out what we're going to do. I hope that we can figure this out during the course of the current year, and that this can guide us then for some years into the future. It won't make our future decisions for us. The nature of a strategy is not that in 3 or 4 years we look back at the strategy and say, oh, this is what we're supposed to do. Okay. Right? It's not a 5-year plan, and I'm not a commissar, despite what it says in the Beaver. The idea of a strategy is that when you face opportunities or problems, you can use it to help stay clear about the big picture and your main goals. That's the biggest advantage to a strategic approach, is that you can remind yourself, in the midst of a panic or in the midst of an enthusiasm, right, what are you mainly trying to do long term? What are you mainly trying to be? Okay, and we will try to do that. And then we will have discussions about tactics that advance the strategy, about specific actions and how they fit into that. Okay? So I hope that we finish that this year, that will guide us in the future. I also hope and strongly intend that we don't stop everything else while we're having a strategic discussion. All right? I've heard worries that there might be a sort of planning blight, right? That while we're doing planning, everything else will stop growing. Right? Well, on the contrary, we've announced 20 new positions to be hired in the faculty. We are announcing new programs. We're going to try to move forward on things that are unambiguously good. Right? It is possible that mistakes will be made, and you should call them to our attention. Though, as we gain clarity in discussions, right, we may begin the process of working out how to implement them. Right? For example, if there were widespread agreement that it's a good idea to enhance our widening participation programs, something that all things equal I would vote for, enhancing access, particularly among British students, to the LSE, and doing this in ways that help to target financial aid, right, or streamline admissions processes without sacrificing standards, right, we might agree that it's important to double these efforts and to double them in time to matter for next year. Right? That doesn't involve such a large number of students that it runs up against the everything is connected to everything else rule, which I have yesterday described as basic to sociology, so I'll hope that Bridget agrees. That is, if we decided to increase the overall student body by 1,000 students, so 1,000 undergraduates in particular, this would undermine our existing policy of trying to provide housing for all first-year undergraduates who want it, and as many as possible. Second year, we would have to also think about residence halls. We would have to also hire faculty. We would have to also raise questions about which department were those 1,000 students going in. Right? Are they all going to study finance? Economics? Right? It's conceivable they will all apply to study anthropology and philosophy. Right? Where will they go? Well, we'll have to wrestle with that problem. What I'm suggesting is the widening participation example, which would likely involve perhaps another 60 students, not in total net numbers, but different students, wouldn't have quite that level of complexity, and we might decide on that sooner. So we can decide on things while we're working, start implementing them, while we continue to look at the bigger picture down the road. This will inevitably report up to the council and to broader constituencies there, out to the public, in here. I'm not asking for confidentiality, but I'm asking for everybody who's a part of the process to be clear about the difference between things being under discussion and things being decided, including even when I say my preference. We haven't decided that we're not going to have overseas campuses just because I said that right now my opinion is that we shouldn't. My opinion could be changed by your arguments. Probably it won't be, but who knows? I don't yet know how good your arguments are. Okay? So that's the plan that I come to you with. I don't come to you with a vision to say, this is exactly what the LSE should be in the future. Precisely the size, precisely the shape, international in this way, with that emphasis on research or that emphasis on teaching. I take a few things as given. We are really committed to teaching. if we aren't, we aren't thinking right. We are really committed to research excellence, and by excellence, we mean excellence. We really mean outstanding, innovative, leading research. We recognize that the REF is only one indicator for this, although it's a very important one to us because it has money attached to it. But we're committed to various manifestations of outstanding leadership and research, right? Just as we're committed to teaching at all levels, bachelor's, master's, PhD advising. We're committed to public engagement. That's part of what's distinctive about the LSE. It connects its teaching and research to the public far more than most institutions. In our public programs here, and in various ways, potential through the web. So I take it as given that we care about teaching, research, and public engagement. I take it as given that we care about new knowledge and not just reproducing the old knowledge. I take it as given that we're serious about being leaders and doing what we do in ways that are influential in the world. But I don't take it as given that we have exactly the right mix of departments or research centers, of degree programs, of students, of staff. All those things I think we need to talk about. I just commit to being a good and friendly part of the conversation. And that's my last point. I do have a goal as director. I want you all to know it. Look around you. There are portraits of past directors. There is not a smiling person among them. The group will soon be gender integrated because Judith Rees is sitting for a portrait. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank Judith for her extraordinary service as director over the last nearly 2 years. I want to integrate the group in another way. Yes, I'm a white man, but I want to be the smiling director. And so my hope is that when I've been director long enough that I might have a chance at a portrait, I will still want to smile about being director of the LSE. So I look forward to the conversation, and may it start now with questions, comments, and thoughts. Thank you. Forgive me if I just point at you and don't try to call everyone by name, even though the first person stood up is someone whose name I do know.
Thank you. Sunil Kumar, Dean of Graduate Studies. Thank you for your very welcoming and inspiring speech. Just a couple of points I wanted to make as observations. I gave two state of the school addresses to the alumni classes of 1980s, 84 and 85 to 89. And I was surprised to see that the funding that came to the school was 54% from trusts and foundations, 16% from alumni, and 11% from companies. This was the range. And the 16% of the funding that came from the alumni was from less than 3% of the alumni. These are the figures I got from the alumni office. And when I spoke to a lot of the alumni, they said that we have a lot that we can do in raising funds through the alumni in comparison to the United States and so on. One of the questions that came up in that state of school address was the proportion of students from Africa that we have at the LSE. So that was just an observation I'd like to make. The second point, Director, is that I know this has been an issue that's been discussed for a long time, is the nursery. As a parent, my son came to the nursery between 2000 and 2004, and I realized what a valuable experience it was being in central London. So from 9 to 6 o'clock in the evening. So when he went to school, started reception, he said, why do I have to go home at 3? Why can't I be here till 6? The nursery plays an excellent part. And as dean, I have come across students who are a bit lost as to what's happening, going to happen with the nursery, the future, and where the children are going to stand. And I think this raises issues, not just of that perspective, but also of the fees that the nursery charges. I know it's very highly subsidized, but what kind of support foreign students might get as a result of that. Thank you.
I take that to be five issues expressed in two questions, Sunil. Let me see if I can remember all of them long enough to comment quickly. One, there are lots of services for which we charge fees. We should look at the impact of charging fees, how much the fees are, and how we set them. Nursery as a case in point. Two, there are things like the nursery that strengthen the community and the workplace of the LSE for its members and should be seen in that light. And there might be a variety of others. I won't try to list. But it is important that we do things that try to support us as a group in the way we work. Three, that the giving to the LSE by alumni is not yet an enormous percentage, either of the alumni or the budget, and there may be considerable room for growth in that. Four, that research funding to the LSE, and I think the funding breakdown you had reflected primarily research, so it didn't include student fees and the teaching component of the LSE, that research funding is disproportionately coming right now from foundations and trusts. That's not a bad source of funding. We're happy about it. But to the extent we want to expand research, we might think of alumni and other private donors as important parts of an expanding research budget. And fifth, people who have been at the LSE really like it, from Sunil's son up to those alumni who potentially give us those donations. We have an institution that attracts loyalty, and we should be prepared to reach out to some of our loyal alumni friends, and I plan to ask Sunil's son for a donation. No more questions from Sunil.
He has started a car washing business.
Ah, the African students point. Good. So we are extraordinarily global, and our global population is skewed in various ways. It's skewed partly because it is shaped by those who can pay. It's not only skewed for that reason. It's skewed by available secondary schools and other sorts of things around the world. I think that we may well wish to try to find the resources to provide more scholarships to international students, as well as to British students, to postgraduates, as well as to undergraduates, and to attempt to make the LSE's student body as diverse internationally as it can be. I would add it's an extraordinarily southeastern English population who come as English students. We've had the benefit of having Alex Peters Day, and we know that people from Yorkshire can be good students, and therefore we may wish to do the same within Britain as well. Yeah, just next is Amanda Grayshire.
Yeah, my name is Christian List. I'm in the government department and philosophy department. Many of us worry that in the British higher education sector in general, the model of democratically governed republics of scholars is being increasingly threatened and replaced by a model of top-down, line-managed institutions. And so I was wondering whether you share this concern and also how you see the future of democratic governance at the LSE.
As a follower of Greek political thought, I keep hoping that if there is a history of democracy and oligarchy, there may eventually yet be a history of monarchy or tyranny. And I no, I'm skeptical about the Republics of Scholars model, but I am concerned about the same issues. Here's why I'm skeptical. I think we forget the extent to which part of our idealized history was an era of democratic republics of scholars, but of semi-feudal universities with extremely powerful professors ruling over those under them. And that there was a republic in some of the same sense as some of the Italian city-states that we know from Machiavelli and others. That is to say, there were a few powerful men who were approximate equals and entitled to participate in the government, and a lot of people subject to them. So parts of what became the, if you will, bureaucratizing of universities, like the introduction of departments at the LSE, were in part attempts by larger numbers of people to create decision-making units that would counterbalance some of the more or less complete authority of professors. I think that this is a complicated history, in other words, and I think we look at a complicated situation now. So democracy is an ideal that suggests to me something yet to be achieved, not simply a return to any recent status quo ante. I think that there have been better and worse institutionalizations of this. So I'm skeptical about a little bit of the history. But on the principle, I think we need participatory decision making. I think that we fail in departments when we do not include the whole department in decision making about what new colleagues to hire. For example, I think that's one of the basic failings sometimes of collective participation. That may or may not come all the way to democracy, but of a real collective participation. I think that we have potential of losing collective participation when we have what I gather by precedent is a relatively well-attended academic board meeting, but it's a small percentage of the faculty, and we have to decide things in votes. We need to try to get as many people involved as possible in making important decisions. So I would like transparency, right? That is, I would like it to be possible to see what's going on in the institution and thus to form good opinions based on good evidence wherever you sit, whether you're the most recently hired lecturer or you're a full professor. I would like there to be opportunities for discussion that are inclusive and bring people together in groups of different size. I think that there's no one model that counts as the perfect democratic model. That is to say, is it the mass meeting? Is it the ballot mailed out by paper? Is it what? There are various decision-making models. We will have to talk about what works for us. I'm content with coming to meetings like this and having discussions. I think that some of the role of senior management in universities or centralized management, the role of growth of services is complexity and dealing with issues that come up. I suspect everybody agrees with that. And the question is partly what sort of checks and balances are there? What sorts of ability to follow up and to question rather than trying to do everything by mass meeting? So I'm committed to an open style of interaction. I can say open pretty unambiguously and claim it. I'm committed to an inclusive kind of discussion in which all the different members of the teaching staff get to participate, and indeed members of the services, other constituencies that are important to the university, students, right? Whether that means that every decision would be made by voting among what constituency, I see as a more complicated question, which it's not always clear to me how that works and where the balance is to be found between, as it were, lines of authority, if you will, particular responsibilities, and the broader view. I think for many issues of academic policy, right, we don't believe in a vote of the whole. We, for example, believe in a vote of a department to settle a question about a program. We have a complicated structure of governance as a result. For my taste, it's almost too complicated, right? We have a lot of committees. We have a lot of paperwork flowing, a lot of time demands for participation in the administration. I worry that we get less participation on some of the big issues because we demand a lot of attention to a lot of other kinds of managerial roles of department heads and of other sorts of people. But the bottom line, and it's a really important question to ask, is finding the way to get everybody who is contributing as a part of the institution involved in the decision-making of the institution. Though for some people, that will be departmental more than this bit scale of meeting. For other people, it will be more the big meeting. Some things will still be done by committees. So that's a half answer on the road to saying, yes, absolutely, I embrace democracy. Because I want to be clear from the front that I think there's a complication to simply embracing democracy as an ideal that in some general sense we all embrace, but which isn't clear what it means when it comes to decision-making in the university. Please.
Thank you. Eve Middleton-Kelly, Complexity Research Program. There are two things you mentioned and I think have huge potential, and I wonder if you could share some of your thinking on them. One is public engagement and the other is philanthropic giving. Both could go in many, many directions, and I just wondered if you could tell us a little more.
So great question about philanthropic giving and public engagement. And it's not unrelated to thinking about democracy and all the things. Who decides and where do they go? So the reason I put first in my discussion of strategy, trying to be clear what our purposes are, what we want the LSE to be, is very basic. So I think the most basic thing in deciding, for example, what philanthropic gift we want to pursue and potentially accept is clarity about whether this advances our mission. So we have a different view towards philanthropic gifts that will provide for core needs, say scholarships for students. That we have, and I'm going to guess you will all agree with me, but maybe you won't, that this is a core need, right? Or chairs for faculty members or a variety of things. It becomes more complicated and a question that we need to discuss and debate in appropriate groups when the mission of the donor and the mission of the university are not obviously congruent. So I said chairs. I will bet that we will all agree that there should be more endowed chairs at the LSC, right? But then we might question a particular endowment, saying it's too narrowly specified, or it's at odds with the way the department into which it would go views its work and its mission, right? Or it is the donor in question doesn't recognize the need for an arm's length relationship and wants to name the incumbent of the chair. Right? And so I think in any of those cases, we would have legitimate questions. Even if it would be welcome to have a £4 million gift, we should ask whether it's we are willing to pursue these gifts in some cases, not because there's something wrong with them, just because they are core to our mission. Right? If we receive an endowment, I don't know why we would, but an endowment for a chair in chemistry, right, that would oblige us to build a chemistry department, we may not want to do the rest of what it takes to do that. And the same thing could go for a research center or something else. There are grants which don't pay for all the costs that would be required to be excellent in the area of the grant. And we would have to be skeptical about that. And there are things we should reject, like the chair coming from a donor who wants to name the incumbent. Even if we like the incumbent, that's not a good governance practice for us. Much the same thing for public engagement. I'll state it more briefly. There are lots of ways for people to engage and use their academic knowledge in public affairs. They can be politically partisan. They can run for office. They can write pieces for the newspapers. We can have people come and speak here. We hold conferences. Our core mission is most advanced by the work that is most closely linked to research and teaching in the social sciences. So the farther we go from work that has a basis in our scholarship, our research, into public engagement that is based simply on the pursuit of opinions or arguments about opinions rather than related to the research, the farther we go from our core mission. We don't forbid that, as we don't censor our faculty's right to do that, but that isn't the mission we pursue, allocate resources to, and try to build a program in. At the same time, we believe that it's good for the university, as well as for the public, to hear from people from other walks of life. Right? When we invite Kofi Annan to come speak at the LSE, it's not because we think he carried out a research project recently, which we would like a report on. Right? It's because we think we and the general public will be stimulated and our knowledge improved by hearing from Kofi Annan some of what he learned about running the United Nations. And so there's going to be judgment call, right, repeatedly in philanthropy and in public engagement. And I think there's no set of rules. I would stress that we have now a new ethics committee. We have new procedures in various areas of the LSE designed to do better with philanthropic giving. However, you can never do so well that there are no more judgment calls, right? You can never do so well that you never face a situation where you have to decide, is this within the rules or outside the rules? What are we doing? Is this going to pose more risks than it brings benefits, right? We will have to try to be wise in those judgment calls, but not pretend to ourselves that we've found some magic formula for escaping judgment calls. Yeah, in the back.
Hi, it's Simon Hicks from. Simon Hicks from the Government Department. I very much welcome your focus on the potential of us shifting students from master's degrees to undergraduate degrees, and I just wanted to hear a bit more about your thinking on that, because I think for a long time, I've been in this place, I think for 17 years, and I remember it being largely driven very much by us teaching and delivering master's programs, and with the undergraduates largely forgotten. And with the changing of the undergraduate funding regime, my prior assumption now is actually the undergraduates are probably cross-subsidizing the masters, in that our master's students on average are paying only 50% more than our undergraduates, but they cost probably twice or even three times more to teach.
Thanks, Simon. So the question is, has the abolition of the old funding regime and its replacement by a new student fees regime deeply changed the way we approach master's and undergraduate teaching, and or what cross-subsidizes what? I'm in agreement with what I think everything Simon said in the direction of it, I'm actually not as sure that we've shifted to a cross-subsidy by undergraduates of graduates. I actually doubt that that's the case. But I think we should try to look and have an evidence-based discussion. That is, it's not your hunch or my hunch, but we should look at the information about what's going on with fee flows. The average amount paid by an undergraduate is less, but then do undergraduates cost as much? How do we cost that out? I'm not sure we have an absolutely perfect handle on this, but this is the sort of thing that I hope we'll work on this year to get the handle and then make the decisions about value. My only qualification of that, and it goes back to my comment about democracy, is some of that will be a school-wide decision about how to think about funding, number of students, and emphasis on different levels of courses. Some of it will be departmental decisions. How much does one department wish to choose undergraduate teaching, and how does it pursue it? How does another decide to pursue master's teaching? And there, the last comment about what I think I at least will try to pursue centrally. I think we have to be serious about teaching. I think it's not just a question of whether we have more undergraduates or more graduates and how the funding flows. I think it's a question of whether we really are seriously committed to teaching, whether we are serious about evaluating teaching and learning from the evaluations, whether we are serious about putting time and effort into organizing what we offer and rethinking it, including in light of new technologies, though not mainly that, mainly just good practice. Paul Kelly, who's here, is new as the pro-director for teaching and will be proposing to academic board a renewal of the teaching task force that Jan Hartley led, a teaching task force too, which will include within its remit postgraduate teaching. And trying to look at whether we are doing as well as I think we like to believe we're always doing in our taught master's programs. Yes, sir.
Hi. James Putzel from International Development. Do you have an idea, coming from the other side of the pond? Is this not on?
Just hold it closer.
Yeah, now. Okay. What are we not doing in relationship to fundraising that we should be doing? I mean, I think I agree very much with your message that it has to be based on our own decisions, our strategy of where we want to go. But looking at the university scene in the United States, for instance, and looking at, you've had a chance to familiarize yourself with what we've been doing, do you have ideas about what's really not being done in fundraising?
I'm going to give you a slightly flip and very American answer first and then more. The slightly flip answer is asking. I think we are not really, seriously, very systematically asking. We're not asking for large amounts. We are sort of thinking it's a nice thing if somebody happens to send us a check for £50, right? And we should be much more serious about this, and that includes being serious about keeping in touch with all of our alumni, building other friendship relations with people who may see their philanthropic attentions potentially realized through our great strength. Let me point out, it's not just a matter of sentiment and loyalty from alumni that produces fundraising. It's a matter of people who have at least two other motivations, one of which we're going to feel ambivalent about, but I don't think is a serious problem. But it's an issue to watch. The one we feel ambivalent about, I think, is they want to join our club, right? That what a number of wealthy people are doing when they make donations is associating themselves with a distinguished institution, right? When Run Shaw gave money to Oxford, it wasn't because he was an alumnus of Oxford. He didn't buy his daughter a place at Oxford, right? It was a legitimate motivation, but a different motivation, right? He wanted to support Chinese studies at an extremely prestigious university that he would be proud to be associated with. He wanted to be able to go to dinners of donors and be with people he liked to have dinner with. Okay? So I think that we can't turn up our noses at that motivation. But I think there's another motivation that we should embrace, which is that many of the people who give philanthropic gifts have a purpose. They may be somebody whose life was transformed by an education at the LSE. They were the first university graduate in their family. And they look at students today and they say, very few of our students are first generation at the university now. I want to give money for a first-generation student to come to the LSE. Or they may say, I'm very worried about climate change. I want to give money to the Grantham Institute because I think it's doing work that is going to help deal with the issue of climate change. And I think we have to recognize that donors have purposes. Now, as I said in answer to Eva, we won't always think those are purposes close to our mission. And so sometimes that will be reasons for not accepting the money. But I think part of what, for better or worse, some of my American colleagues have figured out is that lots of people who have money have good intentions and recognize that universities can be helpful to realizing and making more practical some of their good intentions. That if they advance research on a medical issue, on climate change or something, they are dealing with problems in the world in a way that makes their wealth effective. Now, we want to know things like, how was that wealth acquired? If it was acquired from human trafficking, we really don't want it to become the source of an LSE endowment. Okay. But we do think that for those people who have wealth, it's a good thing to use that wealth to advance educational opportunities, to advance social science research, to advance attention to big issues in the world. And I think in terms of the transatlantic difference, a large part of the difference was realizing that there were potentially very positive outcomes, not just distortions, from external funding. But then getting serious about figuring out which are which, asking, but only asking for the things that you really believe will advance your mission. I think Cambridge and Oxford have figured this out, right? They have run very successful, very large fundraising campaigns. They have taken some gifts that if I were a member of the faculty, I might ask questions about, but for the most part, without losing a sense of the mission of each of Cambridge and Oxford. Some other British universities are getting better. We, 15 or 20 years ago, could have said we were one of the leaders in this, but we're now being passed by Bristol, by Imperial, by a variety of other institutions. I think we can be in the lead, but there's my sense of how to be serious about it. Please. Gentleman in the green sweater. Please ask me a really hard question. I've been told you are... Yes.
I'm glad you've done your research. My question is very simple. Should we rename ourselves as associate professors, assistant professors, and possibly change the email address to .edu?
On the first of the two questions, I don't give a damn, to be honest. This one doesn't exercise me at all, right? In relation to career structure, it seems to me very important that we have clear criteria for promotion, that we have clear opportunities so that people know how they can move through a career hierarchy, and that we have an orderly progression. Whether we call them rank 1, 2, 3, lecturer, senior lecturer, professor, or what else is the question, right? And so I have relatively weak opinions. I will be guided by the opinions of others as to whether the international recognition of reader is a question mark or the distinction that reader has conferred locally is a great virtue. This is something on which I have weak opinions. I mean, I'll probably vote if we have a vote, but right. I'm one of the things I'm trying to model about decision making, net of democracy, is I'm just going to be honest with you and tell you what I think of these things. The second one actually crossed my mind as I was beginning to use c.calhoun@lsc.ac.uk in relation to .edu and was aware that .edu is entirely available, that lsc.edu would be a possibility, that is that the regime. So this is a reflection. For any of you who don't follow internet addresses and suffixes and aren't part of WIPO discussions, this is simply a matter of international convention with a semi-legal backing that marks what it means to have a hegemonic global superpower. That the hegemonic global superpower requires everybody else to put their national initials at the end of their internet address and does not do it itself. So .com and .edu and so forth grew up as U.S. internet addresses, whereas every other country had to say something like .co.uk or whatever. Now, it happens that there are many evidences of the U.S. superpower status fading, and one of them is it's not completely dominate WIPO, and that's no longer true of internet address assignment, and so it would be an option to change it. So I thought about it. I thought, well, sort of more complex the way we have it now, maybe be better. But I gave up that thought. Now, that one, I thought it was better to actually stick to the identity that we have than to mess with it. Yeah, here.
Are there areas or themes or problems or issues across the social sciences, across the waterfront, where you would particularly like to see the school developing its profile and prominence?
Yes, lots and more than we will actually manage to do. So are there themes that cut across the social sciences, which we'd like to do? Well, we do work on some themes that cut across the social science already. I mean, I mentioned climate change, for example. I mentioned cities and urbanization. Development would be another. We have people not only in the finance program working on issues about finance, financial regulation, risk management, and so forth. So I think we do this. I have some that interest me more than others. What interests me most in this is actually doing it, and I think we do it a little less than we might. That is, we have a strong structure of departmental alignments, mostly disciplinary departments, though not always. A few of them are subdisciplinary or quasi-disciplinary or something. And we have a variety of centers and institutes, but these don't consistently do the interdisciplinary linkage that I would wish. Some do a great job of it, some do less of it. So I would wish for the LSE that at any moment when a donor, I'm going to guess this isn't you, potentially interested in offering £2 million to a research center says, what are the 4 or 5 interdisciplinary programs where your researchers across the different fields are committed to advancing knowledge in order to improve society? I would be able to give an answer based on what you collectively are doing, not just on what I like. Like, I'm really interested in various issues pertaining to urbanization in cities, because it comes out of some of my own work, community and things. The book I'll never get to write because I took this job would have been about some of those things. Now, that's not the basis for deciding this, that I happen to have a personal interest. But I would try to urge a collective discussion of what are the 3, 4, 5 issues that we would point to as thinking are important across fields. We would never think that's to the exclusion of everything else, but we might want to work on it and make sure that we do this in an interdisciplinary way. Nobody asked me, but I will volunteer. I said, you know, what are some of your early impressions of the LSE? I said, well, here's one. The LSE thinks it's more interdisciplinary than it is. The LSE believes in being interdisciplinary, talks, you know, says we're interdisciplinary. When you ask people why they think it's a good idea to have had the 9,000 student cap or other things, says, well, we want to maintain our interdisciplinary community. So there's a strong belief in this. There's a weaker practice than belief. I think that we have a stronger ideology of interdisciplinarity than actual practice. And I would hope we find a handful of ways to build interdisciplinary connections for people whose main appointments will nonetheless be in disciplinary departments.
About teaching, you talked about our campuses overseas here, whatnot.
Are non-existent.
And fair enough, but that's a physical world. There's also the online world. And this morning I woke up to the BBC headline about online education. And there's the West Coast Consortium, UCL, I think, is part of it, Edinburgh is part of it. I mean, this is a big bite, but right. any thoughts?
Right. I think you refer to Coursera, founded with Stanford leadership and including now Edinburgh and a variety of others. My decision, it will be made and guided by this collectively. My view of this is that we should be asking what it is we have distinctively to offer, and what the impacts of this are for our other programs. So I will comment very briefly on it. Right now, I see very little advantage to joining a large-scale move towards massive online educational offerings. I think that there may come a time when we want to do more outside and beyond our primary educational work with our own students. But a first step would be exploring what the new technologies can offer to the teaching we're actually doing with the students we're actually enrolling. And from my very preliminary, 7 weeks on the job, very preliminary look, I think we have a ways to go in finding how to utilize new electronic technologies to better serve our existing students. So that should be a priority. Paul Kelly's pointed out, I think quite rightly on multiple occasions, the original notion of the massive online open course from Stanford, this calculus course from a retired professor of mathematics, involved a course he had taught internally to Stanford online for a number of years before it made it open to the larger world. I think that that makes sense. I think imagining, or let alone trying to incentivize people to suddenly switch gears from teaching face-to-face to developing these courses is a big leap. It would make much more sense to work on what would be useful in your teaching now. How can we support you in getting that? What equipment or training or assistance is needed here? How do we supplement that? I think teaching will change. That is, I think, for example, the availability of online resources of various kinds will change what people should be doing in the classroom. And we need to be attentive to that and how people will use it. The ability to use the technologies interactively, some of the kinds of things Jonathan Leap has been pioneering in LSE 100 are things we can use more widely, right? But our primary niche still, from my point of view, is education to students who have been admitted to the LSE. That's one. Two, though, we have joint degrees in Beijing, right, and around the world. I have Beijing on my mind because I just had lunch with Brendan Smith. Our ability to run joint degrees globally, to offer enhanced educational opportunities at multiple sites, is considerably increased by web technologies, right? So that without some of these technologies, we couldn't do multi-sited executive master's degrees or other kinds of special offerings. And I think there may be growth in those special offerings. There may be very exciting things for us to do, but they should grow out of our core teaching.
Hi, I'm Jane Tinkler, and I'm part of the Public Policy Group. And in the interest of full disclosure, before my question, we run four of the LSE's academic blogs. So I wondered what you see as the value to the school of using social media as a way to really raise the profile of academic research that's going on within the school.
Great. So short answer. So social media, including blogs, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you want to have it, but overlapping the website, which is not a social medium and not for the most part interactive, but all of this sort of wave of new interactive and non-interactive electronic technologies. I think these are really valuable. I think that our work can have considerably more impact and be more widely read by virtue of not just being advertised, but sometimes being made available online, sometimes being made available in short formats, digested, rather than in its full length and fully footnoted versions. Being discussed, I think that debate and comment actually attracts attention to work. I was involved in establishing a blog called The Imminent Frame, which is a blog on religion and social science research and in the U.S., which is a very active, wide influence in the field of research, right? So from that, I would take the conclusion, really effective, right? Really time-consuming, and a decision about how you're going to edit or curate the work, how you're going to deal with the responses that come in. So I think that about 99% of academic blogs don't really get off the ground because people don't conceptualize how much time and attention will be involved and don't do the work. When they get off the ground, they can play a really important role. And I don't have an answer to how we think about that in our academic incentive system for teaching, research, and public engagement. It's a kind of public engagement. It's a kind of teaching, perhaps. It gets research out into the public. But I think we don't quite know yet what to do in thinking about what kind of achievement this is to make a blog really effective.
So, when am I supposed to stop? Hi, Greg. Still working. Jan van den Heuvel, Mathematics Department. I'd like to ask a question. I mean, how are you going to deal with the following, what I think is a serious issue? The outcome of the project is great ideas for all kinds of things we're going to do, new things, exciting things, expanding things. But for the, let's say, the faculty on the ground, with a lot of these things often feel like we're going to be asked, required to do more of this, that, and the other, to start new initiatives, but nothing is taken away from us. Yeah? So how do you kind of say, well, that's not going to happen this time because I've thought about it and that's my strategy?
No, this is a great question, right? To what extent is saying there are a lot of new exciting things to do a speed up in simply adding tasks? And lots of tasks have been added already. The number of different things and kinds of engagement, I think, has gone up. Lots of people do lots of things. That doesn't mean that all staff work equally or anything else. And I don't plan to promise that there won't be anything new. So I actually don't plan to promise to solve this problem. But I do think there are some things that mitigate this problem. Right? The competition of different tasks for our time will be something that goes on. I'm willing to bet went on 100 years ago that people went to senior common rooms and complained about how much they were teaching. Why, I have 7 undergraduates this term, you know? So some of that won't go away, but it's a serious question. So here's the first part. I think that we can significantly increase the reward, right? So that part of what we can do is significantly shift, right, some of the reward system for this. I think the second thing that we can do is increase the teaching staff of the LSE and share some of these burdens among a larger number of people. I think we can do some of that better organized already, and some of it will depend on how successful we are in fundraising and so forth. I think that we can look at the burdens that we impose and ask which of them are really crucial. And this goes back to the question of democracy. I said in answer to that, we have a lot of committees and participation takes a lot of time. It is the famous Oscar Wilde line about socialism taking too many evenings. We need to decide how we want to spend our time and figure out how we strike the balance between being represented in decision making and having time for our research, time for our teaching, time for our public engagements. And I would hope that wouldn't go to either extreme. Right, but it's a somewhat significant collective decision. Some of the things that I'm talking about, it seems to me, aren't new. Right? Saying we should be really serious about teaching shouldn't be an extra task for most of you. You should say, well, yeah, I am. Right? And you should be able to look at yourself and say that you really mean that. Some of these are potentially. Right? Take fundraising. Right? Donors don't give money to anonymous institutions. They want to meet the director. They often want to meet faculty members in the area that they might support. If they're going to give money to the economics department, they want to see some economists. They want to talk to them about the work of the economics department. They want to hear things. Why is the LSE economics department special? It's the highest ranked department not in America. That's already special, right? But it's also a department that's distinctively real-world orientated. It does work that connects to contemporary policy issues through the CEP and in other ways. Well, that means that I've got to get Danny Kwa, who's actually pretty readily accessible, and John Van Rienen, who's harder to convince, to come out and want to talk with the donors, right? And that's extra work. So I'm not going to say that that's not happening, right? But the payoff to that is, if this is support, say the support for the CEP in the John Van Rienen case, and make an example of him, right? Since he's not here. This is then grant proposals for relatively small amounts of money that don't have to be written because there's a more stable line of support from a donor. This is support for having an administrative assistant in a center that might not be possible entirely from grant funds from research councils. There are various ways in which this can, in fact, improve the operations. And so I really do think that that's possible. But I'm not going to pretend that this isn't asking for some kinds of work collectively from the community. It is. Even just the strategic discussion is asking you to think about the LSE as a whole, not just your own line of research or your own department. Please.
you've talked a lot about we should all be committed to teaching, but of course members of the faculty have different views. Some aren't much good at teaching or don't much like it. Some are much good at research and don't much like it. One thing that's been floated in the last year at LSE is the idea of having teaching track careers at the school. To be honest, it's been floated more as a threat than an opportunity. But I wanted to ask your view on teaching track and research track careers, or whether you would support what we've done at the school for a long time, which is have the view that all faculty should be expected to put effort into research, teaching and administration.
My first comment is, put this on the table. It's one of those things we can discuss. And I think it will be on the table because I've heard it already raised by people. To what extent should we have teaching track or research track? To what extent should we sometimes have professors in practice? We have the option of that. Do we use it as much as we want to? And so forth and so on. That said, I will now proceed to be honest and tell you my opinion, which is I would be worried if overall we gave up the idea that faculty appointments combine teaching and research. So while I think there might be occasions when it's very appropriate to support somebody who's terrific at teaching in focusing on teaching, terrific at research and focusing on research, I think that we would lose a great deal if we lost the model of faculty members as intellectuals who did teaching, research, and public engagement, and with greater or lesser eagerness, some administration. Or maybe not. Paul.
This is mischievous and not directed at any of the questioners. Do we have too many departments?
I was hoping you were going to ask, do we have too many committees? And I was sure the answer is yes. Too many departments? No, not in the abstract. I don't think there is an abstract right or wrong answer. Do we have the list that I would draw up if I just sat down to say what were the most important 22 departments to have for an institution in this field? Probably not. Would I, if asked a year ago what the fields of social science were, have given a list of 22? No. All right. Are some of the departments more essential? Well, you'll be glad to know I think those that are in the name of the institution are pretty important, right? But I don't think there's an abstract answer to that. I don't think there's any one or no right answer. I do think that it has to be on the table for discussion. And your mischievous question is close to my serious intent. Are we organized in the way we want to be organized in? We have very large departments and very small departments. Is that a problem or is that just fine? I don't know the answer yet, but let's ask. Thanks, everybody. It's been a good discussion for me. Thanks.